The idea of this presentation is to hopefully give you some better understanding of the infection, the COVID infection, and the vaccines, and how they've been produced, what kinds there are, how they work, and then some practical information about the two that are available already in Canada and some that will be coming soon. So I've just acknowledged my sources here. The good pictures come from this Health Canada webinar back in December, and other information from different sessions that I've attended, as well as articles I've read, and some more, even more recent information from the last couple of days. So I'm due to my technical incompetence, I'm not able to advance the slides. So Michael is going to do that for me. So I'm going to have to say next slide frequently. So this is an interesting picture. It actually shows a greatly enlarged picture of the virus on the left-hand side. And it's called a coronavirus. And that's because, as you can see in the picture, it looks a bit like a crown. If you were looking down from above the king's head or the queen's head, you'd see this crown. And that's why that's where it gets the name. On the right-hand side, you have a drawing which represents the structure of the virus, with these little blue knobs that look a bit like golf tees sitting on the surface. Those are the spikes. So you've heard a lot about spikes and spike protein. That's roughly what they look like. The virus is spherical. Inside the coating is the material that's involved in the replication of the virus. And this is RNA material in this particular virus. Viruses come in DNA and RNA. So that's basically what makes up the structure of the virus. So the nuclear material codes for all the proteins, including the spike protein, and the ability of the virus to take over the cell that it infects and reproduce itself, killing the cell in the process. So next slide, please, Michael. So this, again, is a representation of the virus. In this case, the spike proteins are represented by the little orange triangles. And the way that the virus gets into the cell is by that protein attaching to what's called the host receptor, which is in blue on the surface of the cell. So one of our body cells is attacked by the virus. The attachment occurs at that point, and then the virus enters the cell and does its work. The body reacts to these surface proteins with an immune response, and the main response is production of antibodies, which are represented by these this blue structure in the upper right, called anti-spike protein antibody. So that's the body's immune response. That antibody sits on top of the spike protein and doesn't allow it then to attach to the receptor to get into the cell. That's essentially how it works. And so that will happen if someone is exposed to the virus and produces natural immunity. And it also is the mechanism for the vaccines. Next slide, please. So, as I was just mentioning, the vaccines in one way or another expose our immune system to the spike protein, and then the body produces antibodies. And then if we're exposed to the virus, there's a brisk immune response with a lot of antibodies produced that then coat the virus spike proteins, and it can't infect us. And that's how it works. Next slide, please. So this just shows what goes on in a cell to produce a protein. So in our own cells, and this is true of all proteins that the body makes, the code for the protein is in the DNA. That's the double-stranded blue inside the nucleus. That's transcribed in the nucleus into what's called messenger RNA or mRNA. That's the single red strand. It's also wiggly. That goes out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm, the main part of the cell, attaches to a little organelle called a ribosome. That's not named here. And then it codes for the protein. And that's called translation. And in this diagram, the orange beads or the amber beads represent a protein. So that's how our bodies produce protein. And that's what happens when the virus produces its protein and when the vaccine stimulates the production as well. Next slide, please. So there are different kinds of vaccines. All of them in the end lead to the production of this spike protein or introduce it as a unit. And it's the body's immune reaction to that spike protein that ends up in protection. So there are some of the vaccines actually introduce a portion of the protein. They're called protein subunit vaccines. So they actually deliver the protein that's in the vaccine itself. That leads to a strong antibody response and protection. Now, the downside of this kind of vaccine is that it often takes a lot longer to manufacture than some of the newer technologies. But there are several protein subunit vaccines that are being produced. And I think the two listed here, Novavax and Sanofi, are ones that Canada has signed up for. The Canadian government has signed up for some 7 different vaccines. Next slide. So this is another way of introducing the protein in a vaccine, and this is called a virus-like particle. So the vaccine has a structure that looks like a virus. It's empty in the middle, and it has the spike protein sitting on the surface. And so again, the body produces immune reaction to that spike protein. Again, this is a more traditional kind of vaccine, and it takes longer to manufacture. And that's its main disadvantage. That's why we haven't seen these ones yet widely used. Medicago is one of the companies that is producing that kind of vaccine. Next slide. Now we get into the more interesting new type of vaccine. So this is the mRNA or messenger RNA vaccine. And this is new technology. Now, some people have been concerned about how rapidly these vaccines have been produced and some fear that they haven't been well developed and that they might not be safe. The what they call platform for messenger RNA vaccines has been developed over several years. And it just happens that it was ready for the first vaccine a year ago. And so a number of companies, including Moderna and Pfizer, have used this basic technology. And as soon as they were able to replicate the RNA that's responsible for producing the spike protein, they incorporated it and developed their vaccines. Now, so the messenger RNA is again represented by this wavy red line. And because RNA is relatively unstable, it has to be housed in some protection. And so the developers have produced a fatty or lipid small particle called a nanoparticle in which they've placed the messenger RNA, and that's all done in the laboratory. So what happens when the vaccine is given, it finds its way to a cell in our body. It then enters the cell, and inside the cell, the messenger RNA is released. It finds its way to one of those little ribosomes where proteins are produced. It is translated into the spike protein, which then sits on the surface of one of our cells. And because it's foreign material, the body's immune system reacts to it and produces antibodies. So it's a pretty elegant technology. There are, of course, some issues with it, particularly because it's unstable. And so there are a number of practical issues that are important in administering and even transporting the vaccine, but that's how these two work. Next slide, please. So there's another type of vaccine that's also being produced, and this is called a viral vector vaccine. And this is new technology as well. In this case, what the researchers did was they took the RNA from the spike protein and they produced a DNA gene, which is it's a something that the body doesn't do. It doesn't work from RNA back to DNA. But so they've done this in the laboratory. The reason for that is that the DNA is more stable. And they took that little chunk of DNA and placed it inside a hollow virus for transporting the DNA material into the body. And they've taken an adenovirus, which is a kind of virus that produces colds, chest colds, and so on, very common cause of colds and bronchitis in humans. They placed the DNA inside a hollow adenovirus, so there's the virus itself can't reproduce, but that protects the DNA. So then that's what's given in the vaccine. It enters the body. The DNA is released into the nucleus of the cell in a human cell. It then is transcribed onto the messenger RNA, which goes into the cell, produces the spike protein, which again sits on the surface and leads to the immune response. So technology is a little bit different. It has some advantages and possibly some disadvantages, what we'll talk about. So the two that we're already familiar with are the Janssen or Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is the next, which will be the next one to come out in Canada, and AstraZeneca or Oxford University vaccine, which is becoming available in Europe. So just to say that will be probably the next one to come out here will be the Johnson & Johnson. So you've probably heard about how good these vaccines are. And I just wanted to show you what this term efficacy means. So you may have heard that these two vaccines, that the RNA vaccines are 95%, have 95% efficacy. And so in the studies, and these are the so-called phase 3 studies, which are human studies, and they take a population of people and divide them into two groups randomly. So then you have two subpopulations, roughly equal numbers, and half of those people are given the placebo and the other half are given the vaccine, and then they're followed. In the placebo group, a number of them will get infected when they're exposed in the community to the infection, in this case, the COVID infection. And then the vaccine group will also be exposed. In this particular example, 7 of the 8 people in the placebo group got sick, and only 1 of the 8 in the vaccine group got sick. Now, this is just an example. This isn't the actual study results from any of the vaccines. So what that means is the efficacy in this case would be 86%. It's the ratio of people who got sick in the vaccine group to the placebo group. So that's what efficacy is referring to. Now, effectiveness refers to how well a vaccine protects the vaccinated people versus unvaccinated in the real world. So the first is a clinical trial. That's the phase 3 trials that we've heard about. Okay, next slide, please. So now that these two vaccines have been available for a while, I just wanted to go over some of the results of the studies that were done, which allowed them to be released in Canada, US, and other countries. So on the right-hand side is the Pfizer results that were released back around the beginning of December. And in their study, it was a global study, so not just one country, but worldwide, they included 43,000 in the study. They had a subgroup of 18,000 over the age of 56 and up to age 85. They had 12,000 who were from racially and ethnically diverse backgrounds. And the age range was from 12 up to 85. So the results, they were able to report results on, not actually from 12 up, but from 16 up. And so in looking under the final analysis, there were 170 cases of infection in the study group, 162 in the placebo side and only 8 in the vaccine side. So that's where the 95% efficacy comes from. That's that result. they started collecting data 1 week after the second dose. They also were able to show that in the 65 to 85 year old group, the efficacy was the same, 94%. Now they also looked at how many people in the study had severe cases, and there were 10, nine of them in the placebo group and one in the vaccine group. So it protected most people in the vaccine group from getting infected, and most of those who did had mild cases. I guess 7 of 8 had mild cases. And then they were followed for 2 months, and there were no serious safety concerns, which of course is a big issue. And they've been followed since then as well, but these were the results that were released in early December. So looking at Moderna, their study when they first reported was from age 18 up. They reported results in the US only, and they had subgroups of 65 plus. They also had a subgroup of people with high risk, that is, they had other serious illness. And so they tried it on, they included them in the study, and they also included 11,000 of their 30,000 who were people of color. So trying to represent in the study a cross-section of the US population. So in their final analysis, there were 196 out of their over 30,000 who got sick, 185 of them in the placebo group. So again, 94 to 95% efficacy. They didn't report specifically what the efficacy was in the older adults. So the assumption is pretty good, but we don't have actual numbers. There were 30 severe cases, and all of them were in the placebo group. And there was one death also in the placebo group. So that indicates even if you got sick, you had much better protection than those without the vaccine. And again, their safety data were equivalent. So those results were the basis for the release of these two vaccines in December. Next slide, please, Michael. So some of the key messages. So clearly the evidence from those studies indicates that they work. Just another point about, I mentioned this before, there are 7 companies using 3 different methods that Canada has negotiated with. A couple of them are the protein subunit, the older form, the 2 with the messenger RNA and some with the viral vector, including Johnson & Johnson. So the messenger RNA were the first, and I think the information about them is on the next slide. Some of the practical stuff. Okay, so again, looking at Pfizer first on the right-hand side. It's given the vial is a 5-dose multi-dose vial. It needs to be reconstituted, so you have to mix it with normal saline to administer it. The doses are given a minimum of 21 days apart, and I just wanted to comment on that. There's been some concern about the delay in the vaccine, and was this going to cause trouble for people who didn't get the second vaccine within 21 days? The study was done with a minimum of 21 days. That is to say, the 2 doses should not be given any closer than 21 days. In the study, they stuck with that, but there's quite a bit of evidence now to support the fact that it's safe to give them to give the 2 doses more than 21 days. And in fact, the World Health Organization has set a limit for the second dose at 42 days. That seems to be based on the evidence that's coming out in real world studies. Because of the instability of the RNA vaccine, you don't shake this once you've diluted it. And with Pfizer in particular, it has to be stored in an ultra freezer. And that is one of the limitations. That means it can't be given as readily in the community. Once it's unfrozen, it's stable in the refrigerator for 5 days. So it doesn't mean it has to be used immediately, but certainly within 5 days. Once you open a vial, that has to be used within, 6 hours. So if you have a multi-dose vial, you have to be sure you have enough people lined up to use the whole of the vial so you don't waste it. Moderna, on the other side of the slide here, it comes in a 10-dose multi-dose vial. It is all ready to go. There's no dilution required, no reconstitution, so it's ready to inject. It's a slightly larger dose, half a mil, and it's given a minimum of 28 days apart. Again, one has to be careful about stability, but it can be stored in a regular freezer that we all have in our houses. And once it's thawed, it's stable in the fridge for up to 30 days, which means it's much more available, let's say, if it has to be taken out into the community. Next slide, please. So a few points. One is that you cannot get COVID-19 from the vaccine, from either of these vaccines, because the only active ingredient is the messenger RNA, which is produced in the laboratory, and it's only the messenger RNA for the spike protein, not for any other part of the virus. There's a list of non-medicinal ingredients, and the one that's most important is this polyethylene glycol, or PEG, which is thought to be the cause of the allergic reactions if and when they occur. Now, this is a very common substance. It's present in a lot of medications, including cough syrups, face creams. And so it's conceivable that people might, in fact, develop an allergy to it. And that's what is thought to have caused the allergic reactions. The other ingredients are mostly salts like sodium, potassium chloride, cholesterol. These are not thought to be allergenic substances or compounds. Next slide, please. So who should receive the vaccine, or rather who shouldn't? Well, the first contraindication is someone who's has an allergy to one of the ingredients. So the PEG being the most likely. The other is that if someone has active symptoms of the COVID infection, they should not be given the vaccine. And if they have symptoms and they haven't been tested, then they should wait until they're tested and found to be negative. If someone does develop COVID, they should be cleared of the infection first, and then a period of 90 days is what they're recommending before the vaccine is given. They are recommending that people who've been infected get the vaccine anyway, because there isn't a certainty about their immunity based on the infection. Probably the more severe infection that they recover from, the more likely they have a robust immune response. A mild infection, they might not. So who else do we need to be careful about? People with a weakened immune system. It's not that they shouldn't get the vaccine, but they're perhaps more likely to get a weaker response to the vaccine, so they may not get as good protection. People with bleeding problem, that's because it's an intramuscular injection, so that needs to be considered. There are no study results in pregnant women or breastfeeding women, and so we don't know. However, I've been on one webinar where there was an obstetrician involved who said, this has to be dealt with case by case, because some of my patients are at greater risk if they get the infection than they are from any possible side effect of the vaccine. And for Pfizer, we don't have results for under 16. For Moderna, we don't have results for under 18. So those are warnings. But again, there could be, on a case by case basis, people where it's felt it's better to give the vaccine than not, because they may be at risk. And next slide, please. Side effects, yes, they happen. And there's a point here that these two vaccines are referred to as reactogenic. That is to say, they will cause reactions in most people who receive them. And that's because of the brisk immune response they generate. So if someone gets some side effects, that's an indication that the vaccine is actually doing what it's supposed to do. It's causing the immune system to react. So in terms of other vaccines, it's being compared in terms of side effects with the shingles vaccine rather than the annual flu vaccine, because a lot more people don't get any reaction to the flu vaccine. So what are the common side effects? The commonest is pain in the arm at the injection site. Some people, about 1%, report fairly severe pain. The other symptoms are more general ones. Most of these symptoms subside or disappear within 24 hours. Certainly, most people have had, if they have side effects, they'll be more likely after the second dose than the first dose. And that just goes with the comment at the top, which is the immune system is already kicking in quite strongly. So that's a good sign that the first dose actually was effective. I have heard of one person that I know of who was sick for a few days, had to take some time off work. I've also, on the other end of the spectrum, heard people with their second dose who had no reaction at all. People are often advised to take some Advil or Tylenol after the dose to try and limit these side effects. And I know that has worked well for some. Next slide, please. So how common are these allergic reactions? Well, the reporting indicates they occur about 1 in 100,000. And the things to watch for are hives, swelling of the face, but particularly the tongue or throat, and difficulty breathing. It is reported that these serious allergic reactions are no more common with the COVID vaccines than with other vaccines like the flu vaccine. But people, when they receive the vaccine, are placed in observation for a period of at least 15 minutes in case they might develop a severe reaction, because those severe reactions occur very quickly after the injection. And I know I've had my first vaccination a couple of weeks back, and we sat in a holding room for 15 minutes, and where there was a nurse present if anybody had a reaction. And we were given the time when we got our vaccine, and we weren't allowed to leave until at least 15 minutes after. So this is carefully monitored. Next slide, please. So who gets the vaccine? And these are Ontario estimates. So we're in phase one right now, December to March. And the people who have been targeted first are healthcare workers, especially those working in nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and hospital staff who are working with in emergency, in ICU, or in units where there are COVID patients. And then other hospital staff who are exposed to face-to-face with patients. Residents of nursing homes and long-term care, and the elderly living in the community who are receiving home care services, so where there are healthcare workers and others coming into their homes. And then adult members of the Indigenous communities, because they're at high risk. Now, phase two is still expected to begin around the beginning of April in Ontario. And at that point, all healthcare workers will be included. Seniors, all seniors, beginning with those 80 years and over, and then decreasing by 5-year increments. So the next group would be the 75 plus and so on down. Essential workers, including teachers, frontline workers, and also high-risk patients, those who are at risk because of health issues. One example, patients who are receiving chemotherapy for cancer would be high on the list. Others perhaps with severe chest, lung infection, or lung conditions and heart conditions, just as examples. Phase three, which is scheduled to begin in August, and that will open it up to all adults who want it. Perhaps by then we'll know more about the safety and the effect of giving it to people under age 16 as more results come in from studies. Next slide, please. I think we're getting toward the end. Okay, what about Moderna? It was the second to be released. And its efficacy, very similar, side effects and safety, similar to Pfizer. The advantage is, as mentioned, it can be stored in a regular freezer and it's stable in the fridge for a longer period. Dose range a little bit different. In their studies, they actually studied from a range of 25 to 35 days. And it's recommended only for adults. So what about the DNA vaccines, the ones that are about to come? Johnson & Johnson is the first. Their studies showed an efficacy of 66%. Now that sounds like a lot lower than what we heard of before. And it's possible that the Johnson & Johnson isn't quite as good in protection, but the study also was done to show how effective it was in preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and death. And the results there were much better. So it appears that some people might get the infection who got the vaccine, but they would be protected from the more severe infection. Another interesting thing about their studies were that they were done not only in countries that like the US, but also in countries where the new strains had emerged. So some of these 45,000 were done in UK, some in South Africa, and even some in Brazil. So these numbers here may reflect in part the way in which they work against these newer strains. So that's encouraging if that's the case. Johnson & Johnson is a single dose, and there are trials underway to see if by giving a second dose, the efficacy is greater, and that remains to be seen, but that could be the case. AstraZeneca is probably the next one to come on board, and it's two injections, and they're spaced between 8 and 12 weeks apart, so a couple of months apart. Efficacy in the 60% range. Now, as I understand it, this is not yet approved by WHO, but it has been approved in the European Union, and so I think it's being circulated there. It's they're starting to use it, or will be starting to use it very soon. Next slide, and I think we're getting near the end. Variants. So what the significant variants have an alteration in the spike protein, and that appears to mean that they are more infectious, that if you're exposed to them, they have a better chance of getting into the cells and causing infection. There are some studies showing that the UK strain is about 40% more infectious. South African and Brazil strains, there isn't as much information about that yet. Probably they're at least that much more infectious, maybe more so, we're not sure. Now these numbers here are about 2 weeks out of date. At that time, there were some almost 430 cases identified in Canada with the UK strain, 28 South Africa, Brazil, one. I know those numbers have gone up, but it's still that kind of ratio. Next slide, please. Okay, here are some up-to-date numbers just to say, where are we in Ontario? Unfortunately, I wasn't able to show the graphs, but you can find these on the COVID-19 Ontario website if you look carefully. And what it showed was the number of active cases in early November was just under 12,000. By January 9th, we were up to 30,000 active cases. With the changes in the province, the tightening up, we're back down to, in terms of active cases, to where we were in early November. So that those strategies have been effective. Now, new cases per day were just approaching 1,000 in early November. We hit 35,000, 3.5 times that number by the first week second week in January. And now, as of Saturday, we were down just under 1,000. I think we were 900 and something today. Now, that sounds good, and it is. However, we should not look at this to say, okay, now we can do everything we did last summer, because we're nowhere near the numbers that we were at in the summer. We were probably down around 400 per active new cases per day in the summer. The other thing is that these new, more infectious strains mean that to reach where we were in November, we really ought to be down around 500 or 600 new cases, because each new case is going to produce more new cases than the cases did back in November. So not a time to be opening up widely. So where are we in vaccines? Well, as of past weekend, there had been almost 500,000 vaccine doses administered. The ratio was 3-1 Pfizer to Moderna. So about 300,000 plus Pfizer vaccines, about 100,000, a little over 100,000 Moderna. People fully vaccinated, by that time, there are almost 175,000. That means they've received their second dose. Last week, we topped the most doses per week since we started back in December of almost 90,000. And this week, I'm sure we'll be over that. So there was a drop in the number of vaccines administered per week at the beginning of February. But now as more vaccine has become available, we're back up to where we were and going beyond that. And that's hopefully going to just continue. Next slide, please. So I think that's the end of the formal presentation.